A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one, and I love it because it's one of those questions where the answer is simultaneously way more boring and way more terrifying than you'd expect. He's asking, how do logisticians plan for environments where resupply is intermittent or impossible? Think Antarctic research stations, military outposts, naval vessels at sea. What's the actual planning process, the inventory management system, and who are the people doing this work? There's a phrase that kept coming to mind when I was thinking about this. Logistics of last resort. Because when the next delivery window is months away and the cost of running out is catastrophic, everything changes.
The cost of running out in Antarctica isn't, we'll grab more from the warehouse. The cost of running out is, people die. And that's not hyperbole. The British Antarctic Survey requires overwintering staff at some stations to have their appendix removed preemptively before deployment. You cannot be evacuated from the South Pole between February and October. The last flight leaves, and that's it. You're in a closed loop.
Closed loop. That's the phrase. And it's what makes this fundamentally different from a Walmart or an Amazon fulfillment center. Those systems are designed around flow. Stuff comes in, stuff goes out. Algorithms reorder. These extreme environments are designed around a finite bubble of resources with a hard deadline for the next infusion. Once that window closes, you are living on what you've got.
That's the framework we should use to think about this. There are really three archetypal closed-loop environments. 1. Antarctic research stations, where resupply happens during a roughly 4-month summer window from October to February. 2. Naval vessels at sea, particularly submarines and aircraft carriers, which carry everything they need for deployments of 90 to 120 days. 3. Remote military outposts. Forward operating bases in places like Afghanistan or Arctic. Early warning stations, where resupply might be intermittent due to weather, terrain, or hostile activity.
The resupply calculus is completely different in each of these. But they share one thing. The planning horizon isn't, what do we need this week? It's what do we need for the next 6 to 9 months, calculated down to the individual tube of toothpaste.
Let's start with Antarctica, because it's the most extreme version of this. The U.S. Antarctic program operates 3 year-round stations, McMurdo, South Pole, and Palmer. McMurdo is the logistics hub. During the summer season, roughly October through February, McMurdo receives approximately 8 million gallons of fuel and 8 million pounds of cargo. That's the entire annual resupply for the continent's U.S. operations. Everything for the winter over crew has to be on the ice before the last C-17 or LC-30 flight leaves, typically in late February.
8 million gallons of fuel and 8 million pounds of cargo. In 4 months. That's not a supply chain, that's a fire hose.
Here's where it gets interesting from a planning perspective. The winter overpopulation at McMurdo is typically 150 to 200 people. At the South Pole station, it's about 50. You have to calculate, for every single item those people might need, the consumption rate per person per day, multiply by the number of person days you're covering, and then add a buffer.
Let's get concrete. How do you calculate how much toilet paper 100 people need for 6 months?
You start with a consumption rate. Military and Antarctic logistics planners use standardized estimates for literally everything. Toilet paper might be estimated at, say, 1 roll per person per week. 100 people times 26 weeks is 2,600 rolls. Then you add your buffer, typically 15 to 20%, so you're ordering about 3,000 rolls. That's your number. And someone has to justify that number in a cargo manifest.
The buffer isn't just in case people use more toilet paper than expected. The buffer is for breakage, spoilage, contamination, or the cargo pallet falling into a crevasse on the traverse from McMurdo to the South Pole.
Which brings up the last mile problem. The South Pole station is 800 miles inland from McMurdo. Getting supplies there involves either LC-130 ski-equipped aircraft doing multiple flights, or the South Pole traverse, a ground convoy of tractors pulling sleds across the ice sheet. That traverse takes about 30 to 40 days each way. So your resupply planning for the South Pole has to account for the fact that the stuff you ordered in October might not arrive until December, and if anything's wrong, you have a very narrow window to fix it.
Who's actually doing this planning? Is it some AI running simulations? Is it a room full of generals?
It's a surprisingly small team of humans with spreadsheets. At McMurdo, the key person is the cargo supervisor, supported by a team of maybe 3 to 5 logistics specialists. They use a system called the Cargo Management System, CMS, to track every pallet, every container, every item. But here's the thing that surprised me. Many Antarctic supply officers still use paper cargo manifests as backup. When the power goes out or the satellite link drops, you still need to know what's in which container.
There's something deeply satisfying about that.
The U.S. Antarctic Program's logistics are actually managed through a joint operation between the National Science Foundation and the U.S. military, called Operation Deep Freeze. Every year, the military provides airlift and sea lift support. A cargo ship arrives at McMurdo in January with the heavy stuff. Fuel, construction materials, vehicles. Flights bring in the priority cargo. And everything is prioritized using a tiered system. Medical supplies and fuel are what they call mission critical. Those get top priority and the highest buffer margins. Fresh food is a morale item. It gets cut first when weight or space is tight.
The lettuce is the canary in the coal mine of Antarctic logistics.
And there was a great example of this in 2021. A miscommunication in the cargo manifest led to McMurdo running out of fresh eggs for 3 months during the winter over. 3 months with no fresh eggs. The workaround was powdered eggs, which apparently are fine, but nobody's happy about it. The point is, a single line item error in a spreadsheet in October meant 150 people were eating powdered eggs in July.
That's the fragility here. These systems look robust because they're planned so meticulously, but they're actually incredibly brittle. One mistake, one mislabeled pallet, and you're eating powdered eggs for a quarter of a year.
That's Antarctica, where at least the resupply window is predictable. Let's talk about submarines, where the constraints are even tighter. A U.S. Navy fast attack submarine carries enough food for about 90 to 120 days for a crew of 130 to 150 sailors. The total food load weighs roughly 40,000 pounds. Every single pound matters because the submarine has to maintain precise trim and stability. You can't just throw extra cases of Gatorade on board.
That's the detail that gets me. The weight of the food affects the submarine's ability to stay level underwater.
And that means the provisioning is planned to the last ounce. The Navy uses what's called a load list system. Every meal for the entire deployment is pre-planned down to the ingredient level. They operate on a menu cycle, typically a 21-day rotation of breakfast, lunch, and dinner menus. The load list specifies exactly how many pounds of chicken breast, how many gallons of milk, how many cans of green beans are needed to execute that cycle for the full deployment.
It's not to order what we think we'll need and adjust. It's here is exactly what every sailor will eat on day 47 of the deployment, and we've bought precisely that amount.
The U.S. Navy has a manual for this. It's called the S9, the Submarine Food Provisioning Manual. It specifies 2.5 pounds of food per person per day, broken down into specific categories. There's a formula. And the supply officer, typically a lieutenant commander, is responsible for executing this with a team of culinary specialists. But here's the key difference from Antarctica. On a submarine, the crew can pull items from the load list, meaning the cooks can decide which specific meal to prepare from the pre-planned menu, but nobody can reorder. There is no Amazon Prime for submarines.
That push versus pull distinction is important. In Antarctica, supplies are pushed based on forecasted needs. The planners in Denver or Christchurch decide what gets sent. On a submarine, there's pull capability within the preloaded inventory, but no ability to change the total quantity or add new items. Different failure modes. Antarctica's failure mode is, we forgot to order enough of X. A submarine's failure mode is, we have X, but it all spoiled because the cold chain failed.
Let's talk about the cold chain, because it's one of the most underappreciated challenges in all of this. On a U.S. Navy aircraft carrier, which by the way serves 18,000 meals per day, over 1.6 million meals over a 90-day deployment, perishable food is managed across 5 different temperature zones: frozen, deep chill, standard refrigeration, cool dry storage, and ambient. Each zone has specific humidity and temperature requirements. If a compressor fails, you can lose tens of thousands of dollars of food in hours.
A carrier has a supply department of over 200 sailors. 200 people just managing inventory and food service. That's larger than most companies' entire logistics operations.
The supply officer on a carrier is a lieutenant commander or commander, a mid-career officer with years of specialized training. They're managing what is essentially a floating city of 5,000 people with a warehouse that can't be restocked until the next port call or underway replenishment. And they're doing it with a taxonomy that most civilians have never heard of, the Class I through 9 supply classification system.
Break this down. What's Class I through 9?
This is the system the Department of Defense formalized in 1950, and it's still used by every U.S. military branch today. Class 1 is food and rations. Class 2 is clothing and individual equipment. Class 3 is petroleum, oil, and lubricants, POL in military speak. Class 4 is construction materials. Class V is ammunition and explosives. Class V is personal demand items. Think soap, cigarettes, snacks from the ship's store. Class 7 is major end items like vehicles and weapon systems. Class 8 is medical supplies. Class 9 is repair parts and components.
When a logistics officer is planning for a deployment, they're not thinking, what stuff do we need? They're thinking, what's our Class I requirement for 90 days? What's our Class I formulary? What's our Class I meantime between failure forecast?
And each class has its own planning methodology. Class 1 is consumption-based, meals per person per day. Class I is formulary-based. What medical conditions are we likely to encounter? What drugs and supplies treat those? What's the shelf life? Class 9 is the hardest. That's spare parts, and it's forecast using mean time between failure data. MTBF. You look at every pump, every valve, every circuit board on the ship, you know its historical failure rate, and you stock spares accordingly.
It's not order extra of everything. That's the misconception most people have. They just buy more than they need. Space and weight are severely constrained on a ship, on a submarine, on an aircraft flying to the South Pole. Every item has to be justified. Over-ordering isn't just wasteful. It creates disposal problems. It takes up space that could be used for something else. And in the case of a submarine, it literally affects the vessel's ability to operate.
That's where the buffer percentage becomes a strategic decision, not just a safety margin. 15-20% is standard for consumables. But for critical spares where a failure would mean a mission abort, the part that keeps the reactor cooling pump running, for instance, you might carry 100% redundancy, two of everything, and you still might get unlucky.
Let's talk about what happens when things go wrong. Because all this planning, the spreadsheets, the cargo manifests, the S9 manual, it's all the best guess about a future that doesn't cooperate.
There was an incident in 2023. A U.S. Navy carrier had to airdrop insulin to a submarine. A diabetic crew member's supply had been miscalculated. Someone, somewhere, made an error in the consumption rate calculation, or the buffer wasn't adequate, or the sailor's dosage changed mid-deployment. And suddenly you have a submarine somewhere in the Pacific with a medical emergency that can't wait for a port call. So a helicopter flies out from a carrier with a cooler of insulin and they do an at-sea transfer.
That's the human factor. All the systems in the world, and it still comes down to someone filling out a spreadsheet correctly. And the person filling out that spreadsheet on a forward operating base in Afghanistan might not be a logistics specialist. It might be an E6 or E7, a staff sergeant or gunnery sergeant, who got handed the additional duty of supply officer and a clipboard.
That's the reality in remote military outposts. At a large base like Bagram, you'd have a full logistics battalion. But at a small forward operating base with 50 or 100 soldiers, the supply chain is managed by a senior NCO who probably has other primary responsibilities. They're doing inventory counts by hand, radioing in resupply requests, and making judgment calls about what's critical and what can wait.
They're operating in a push system where higher headquarters is deciding what gets sent based on standard load lists. The staff sergeant of the FOB can request things, but there's no guarantee they'll arrive. Weather, enemy activity, higher priority missions, any of these can delay or cancel a resupply convoy or helicopter sling load.
This creates a fundamentally different psychology around inventory. In a normal supply chain, you want to minimize inventory because it ties up capital. In an extreme environment, inventory is survival. Nobody at the South Pole is worried about carrying costs. They're worried about what happens if the Traverse breaks down and the next resupply is delayed by a month. So the buffer isn't a cost, it's insurance. And the premium is paid in cargo weight and storage space.
Let's talk about the consumables versus durable split, because that's where a lot of the planning complexity lives. Consumables are straightforward. Food, fuel, medicine, toilet paper. You calculate the burn rate, multiply by time, add buffer, done. Durables, vehicles, generators, scientific equipment, aircraft, require a completely different approach.
With durables, you're not forecasting consumption, you're forecasting failure. And that's where the MTBF data comes in. For every component on a generator, you know how many hours of operation it typically lasts before failing. You know your planned operating hours for the deployment. You stock spares for the components that are most likely to fail within that window, and you accept that for some low probability failures, you just won't have the part.
In Antarctica, if that part breaks and you don't have a spare, you're not getting one for 6 months. So you improvise. The history of Antarctic exploration is basically a history of improvised repairs, duct tape, baling wire, and desperation.
The U.S. Antarctic program maintains what's called a winter over survival stock. A cache of critical supplies that is never touched except in genuine emergencies. It's the logistics equivalent of a reserve parachute. You plan not to need it, but if you do need it, it's the only thing between you and catastrophe.
How do you plan for a medical emergency when you have a finite formulary? The doctor at McMurdo or on a submarine has a specific list of drugs and supplies. If someone develops a condition that requires a drug not in the formulary, what happens?
That's the nightmare scenario. In Antarctica, during the winter over, there is no evacuation. The South Pole station is colder than the surface of Mars for much of the winter. Aircraft can't operate. The hydraulic fluid freezes. So the station doctor, usually a single physician, has to manage whatever comes up with what's on hand. They carry a broader formulary than a typical primary care practice specifically because they can't refer out. But there are limits. If you need an MRI or surgery beyond basic procedures, you're out of luck.
That's why the British Antarctic Survey requires the preemptive appendectomy. It's not paranoia. It's math. The probability of appendicitis in a young adult population times the number of person days times the consequence of no surgical capability equals an unacceptable risk. So you remove the appendix before deployment.
That same calculus applies to every item in the cargo manifest. What's the probability we'll need this? What's the consequence of not having it? What's the weight and volume cost of carrying it? It's a continuous triage process.
This brings us to the what-if scenarios. How do you plan for a supply ship that's delayed by a month? Or a traverse that hits a crevasse field and has to reroute? Or a compressor failure that takes out your cold storage?
You plan in layers. The first layer is the buffer, 15 to 20% extra on consumables. The second layer is substitution. If fresh produce runs out, you have frozen and canned. If eggs run out, you have powdered. The third layer is rationing. If a resupply is delayed, you cut non-essential consumption. The fourth layer is the emergency stock, the reserve parachute. And if all of those fail, you're into the fifth layer, which is figure it out or die.
That's not hyperbole either. The history of polar exploration is littered with expeditions that got the fifth layer wrong. Shackleton's Endurance Expedition is the famous example. They lost their ship, but Shackleton's leadership and planning meant everyone survived. The Franklin Expedition got it wrong, and everyone died.
Modern Antarctic logistics is designed to make sure nobody ever has to test that fifth layer, and it's remarkably successful. The U.S. Antarctic program has been operating continuously since 1956 without a single winter over fatality due to supply failure. That's an extraordinary safety record.
Let's shift to the practical takeaways, because most of our listeners are not provisioning a South Pole station. But the principles here are surprisingly applicable.
The first one is the buffer percentage concept. Whether you're stocking a pantry, a workshop, or a small business, the 15 to 20% redundancy rule is a good heuristic. For items where running out would be catastrophic, critical medications, backup power, emergency water go higher. For items where running out is merely annoying, snacks, entertainment go lower or zero. But make it a conscious decision, not an accident.
The second takeaway is the consumption rate method. Track what you actually use per person per day or per week for a few months. Not what you think you use, what you actually use. That baseline is the foundation of any good inventory system. Most households have no idea how much toilet paper they use in a month. A submarine supply officer knows to the roll.
The third takeaway is the push versus pull trade-off. This is a strategic decision that applies to any supply chain. Are you going to forecast demand and pre-position supplies, the push model? Or are you going to let actual consumption drive reordering, the pull model? In extreme environments, push dominates because pull is impossible. But in everyday life, most of us use a hybrid. Your pantry is push. You stock it based on what you think you'll need. Your weekly grocery run is pull. You buy what you've run out of.
The insight from Extreme Logistics is that you should be explicit about which model you're using for which items, and you should know the failure mode of each. Push fails when the forecast is wrong. Pull fails when the resupply is delayed. Different risks, different mitigations.
There's a fourth insight that I think is underappreciated, the importance of the paper backup. Antarctic supply officers keep paper manifests. Smart preppers keep printed inventory lists. When the power goes out, when the cloud service is down, when your phone is dead, you still need to know what you have and where it is.
The spreadsheet is great until the battery dies. Then the clipboard is king.
Where does this leave us? The methods for planning extreme environment logistics haven't changed much in 50 years. The fundamental math, consumption rates, person days, buffer percentages, is the same math that was used to provision the early Antarctic expeditions. What's changed is the tools. Better forecasting software, better cold chain technology, better communication. But the core challenge remains, you're making bets about an uncertain future with lives on the line.
The environments are changing. Climate change is making resupply windows less predictable. Sea ice patterns are shifting. Permafrost is thawing under Arctic bases. The assumptions that worked for decades are becoming less reliable. How do you plan a buffer when the baseline is moving?
That's the open question that keeps logistics planners up at night. The rise of autonomous resupply, drones, robotic convoys, 3D printing of spare parts could transform these environments in the coming decades. If you can fly a drone to the South Pole in winter, you don't need to stock 9 months of everything. If you can print a replacement valve on demand, you don't need a warehouse full of Class 9 parts. But the fundamental challenge of forecasting human needs isn't going away. People are still people. We still eat, get sick, break things, and need toothpaste.
Next time you run out of something at home, ask yourself, what would a submarine supply officer do? The answer is probably, they wouldn't have run out, because they did the math 6 months ago.
They have a paper backup just in case.
Speaking of things that do run out, it's time for Hilbert's Daily Fun Fact.
Now, Hilbert's Daily Fun Fact.
During the Cold War, the Soviet Union operated the world's largest over-the-horizon radar system in the Namib Desert, a massive antenna array spanning over 2 kilometers, designed to bounce shortwave radio signals off the ionosphere to detect missile launches from the southern hemisphere. When it was operational, local farmers discovered their barbed wire fences were picking up the signal and audibly playing Soviet radio broadcasts through the metal.
Barbed wire as a speaker. That's a new one.
That's going to stick with me.
This has been my Weird Prompts. Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flemingtop. If you enjoyed this episode, leave us a review wherever you listen. It genuinely helps. We'll be back next week with another prompt from the void.
Until then, count your toilet paper and know your buffer percentage.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, my weird prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.